is our human right. We deserve to be free. This is power to the people.
And that was our show, everyone. Please tune in next week for another episode of We the People Wish You a Better Year. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and it's goodbye.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Throughout this century, the crisis will accelerate unless we stop burning coal, gas, and petroleum now. It's not all or nothing. The question is, how bad are we going to let it be? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Juan Cole, journalist. This article is published under the heading The Cost of Not Acting on Climate? Stay tuned for more. From 1980 to 2021, the National Centers for Environmental Information says that America suffered 310 major climate and weather events of over $1 billion each, the total cost of which in today's dollars is $2.1 trillion. That's a heavy cost for a 40-year period. We will be having to spend that much every day in only a few decades. The past seems near to us, and even a little bit into the future seems distant and clouded with myths. The Brown University Cost of the War Project concludes that the so-called War on Terror, launched by George W. Bush after September 11, 2001 attacks, including the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, extra spending on homeland security and veterans' health care will come to $8 trillion. So by the late 2090s, Americans will be spending that every 4 years. All of the Second World War, including the U.S. conquest of much of Europe and East Asia, cost $4.7 trillion in today's dollars. Americans will be spending that in 78 years every 2.5 days. The Then what will Americans be spending it on? Journalist Gardner says the bills will come due every year, then for coastal disaster relief, flood, crop and healthcare insurance, wildfire suppression and flooding. Throughout this century, the crisis will accelerate unless Americans stop burning coal, gas and petroleum now. The climate and weather catastrophes will be on steroids. Remember how Hurricane Maria flattened Puerto Rico in 2017, how it made landfall in Yabucco with sustained winds as high as 155 meters per hour, having gotten up even higher for a while as one of the U.S. first known Category 6 storms. Warm ocean water increases the ferocity of tropical storms, and because of evaporation, it puts more water into the atmosphere, so the downpours and flooding are worse and worse. That extra moisture contributed to Hurricane Harvey. The 500-year storm, which submerged Houston with its worst flooding on record in 2017. The 500-year storms will come more and more frequently. Then there were those headlines in 2018 that American celebrities had to flee their Malibu mansions before advancing wildfire. There will be more and more such bonfires of vanities. We hear people talking about a point of no return or wondering if it is game over. The climate is not like that. It is not an either-or proposition. Billions of human beings will be living on Earth in 78 years. Things can be merely annoying or challenging or disastrous. The climate crisis is on a scale from 1 to 100. We can land at 15, which is not so bad, or we can land at 95, which will make lives really tough. It all depends on how much carbon dioxide the United States puts into the atmosphere now. Vote for politicians who understand all this and will pass legislation to address it immediately, American experts tell their people. Your children and grandchildren will thank you, they say. But even those of Americans alive the rest of this decade will benefit from drastic action to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Science tells them that the process of warming will cease within a few years of such big cutbacks.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
پیغمبر عرض کردن اللهم سلمنا لرمضان و سلمه لنا و
سلمه. In a beautiful narration, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wa sallam addressed the people at the beginning of the month of Ramadan and asked Allah for two types of safety and healthy during this month. The first one is to keep us safe and healthy for the month of Ramadan. This means to give us the blessing of being healthy and the ability to fast. The second type of safety and health Prophet Muhammad prayed for is the safety of the month of Ramadan for us. Now, this second type might look strange. What does it mean by keeping Ramadan safe for us and keep it safe from dangers?
یعنی می شود ما رمضان ناسالم بشه. چجور؟
It means that the holy month of Ramadan can be unsafe and unhealthy. But how? This is when we break the fast unlawfully or commit sins or violate Allah's rulings. This way, we disgrace the holy month of Ramadan. We take away its safety and soundness. The holy month of Ramadan is the month of Allah. Thus, we have to keep it safe and sound from the dangers and impurities. We, through our sins and faults, can disrespect the month of Ramadan and endanger its values.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. In this holy month of Ramadan, we'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Many Yemenis feel that the war on their country has been forgotten despite its significantly higher death toll and the fact that it is marked by much more blatant violations of human rights. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, On its 7th anniversary, Yemen seeks to end a war the world has forgotten. This is the first part of the article. 7 years have passed since the brutal war against Yemen, a ship-shaped country located on the southern Arabian Peninsula, began in March 2015. The war has been acknowledged as one of the bloodiest in modern history and called the world's worst humanitarian disaster by human rights groups. Yet, rather than breaking Yemeni resolve, the Saudi-led war, backed by collective military might of the world's most powerful nations, has only strengthened the poorest country in the West Asia region. And Ansarullah is now stronger and more united than it has ever been. On the 7th anniversary of the war, Mint Press News spoke with survivors, relatives of victims, and refugees of the conflict, who recount their stories and explore the current state of the conflict, as evidence suggests that the Saudi-led coalition's grip on Yemen may be loosening. I remember when a huge explosion rocked my home, then I went up on the roof. There were fires like a volcano, Murad Yahya told Mint Press, referring to Saudi airstrikes that killed an entire family in Bani Hawat shortly after Saudi Arabia announced Operation Decisive Storm. Yahya, a father in his 60s who was displaced from his home, now lives in a makeshift refugee camp in Dahan Center for Displaced in northern Sana'a. Despite the short supply and high prices of goods, Yahya says he has become more determined to persevere. Today I see the same fires not here but in Saudi Arabia, he said, referring to the images of huge fires that were plastered across international media last week after Ansarullah struck a Saudi state-run oil facility in Jeddah. The attack, which came amid international concerns about the future of energy, was intended to send a message to Riyadh and its allies alike, particularly to the Biden administration, that Yemenis are not only still steadfast and stronger than before, but are resolved to break the stifling blockade on their country that has been imposed by the Saudi-led U.S.-backed coalition since 2015. It is part of a renewed effort by Ansarullah's Air Force to impose a costly penalty on the Persian Gulf nations and their backers for their war on Yemen, which has sparked massive fuel shortages, water shortages, and famine on a near-biblical scale in the world's poorest nation. Dubbed Operation Breaking the Siege Third, the largest-scale offensive against high-value facilities inside of Saudi Arabia will likely bear the hallmark of Ansarullah. Ballistic and winged missiles and drone attacks against the sensitive targets across the Saudi kingdom. Attacks have already struck targets in the Saudi capital Riyadh and the southern cities of Dhahran al-Janub, Abha, and Khamis Mosheid were pounded by dozens of missiles and drones. Energy facilities in the strategic regions of Jizan and Najran and in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah were also struck, along with the oil refineries in Ras Tanura and Rabigh, and a power station in Samta, according to Ansarullah officials. The offensive represents the fiercest operation by Ansarullah against Saudi Arabia to date. It dwarfs the September 2019 attacks against Saudi Arabia's oil facilities in Abqir and Khurais, which led to a suspension of about 50% of the Arab kingdom's crude and gas production. It took over 50 firefighting teams, more than 24 hours, to extinguish the massive blaze from the recent attack on the Saudi oil facilities in Jeddah. Even then, massive plumes of smoke covered the coastal city, causing an unprecedented state of panic. Saudi state-owned media broadcasted every aspect of the attack live in an attempt to either gain international sympathy or alarm the international community. In the wake of the attacks, crude oil prices surged and broke $120 per barrel. While attacks on Saudi state-run oil refineries or gas plants affect the financial returns of the kingdom's royal family, Ansarullah hopes that targeting critical infrastructure like the desalination plant, the main source of water for more than 25 million Saudis, will bring the war to every home in the kingdom and pose a real threat to the legitimacy of the Saudi kingdom, forcing it to end the war and lift the siege.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. National power and strength is vital for every nation. Another element is culture and lifestyle. This is another element of power. If a nation is a mere follower of others in terms of lifestyle, without the power to voice its own opinions, and if it is lacking in a well-established culture of its own, this is naturally a big weakness in national power. Another element is having an attractive logic capable of influencing other nations and of achieving a strategic depth for the country. When you have an attractive logic in the Islamic Republic, which is attractive to other nations and which has great potential to attract others, when you discuss it with them directly, this will be your strategic depth. All these things constitute the interrelated chain of national power. Of course, there are other elements that I will return to later on, the ones which are related to our discussion.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You must note that none of these arms of power should be cut off in favor of the others. We do not have the right to cut off any of these arms of power with the belief that they might be in conflict with the other elements. No, all of them must move forward alongside one another, which is possible. It is really naive if someone suggests that we decrease our defensive power so as not to make the enemies sensitive. In my opinion, there is no statement which is more simple-minded than saying that we must decrease our defensive power and our foreign security muscle so that the enemies do not become sensitive. For instance, such opinions claim that we must not have any regional presence so that such and such a superpower will not be on bad terms with us and will not have an excuse. No, regional presence is our strategic depth. This, in itself, is a tool for the power and strength of the Islamic government. Why should we lose it when we can and must have such a thing? I could equally mention the suggestion to forego our scientific progress.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Limelight. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have, in many cases, risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world, says Stephen Zeun's journalist in an article titled Democrats attack Amnesty report on Israeli regime to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Please stay tuned. The Biden administration and congressional leaders of both parties have launched a full frontal assault on the integrity of Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization. This decidedly mainstream non-governmental organization, NGO, which is a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, boasts more than 10 million members worldwide and is cited frequently by the U.S. government agencies, was embraced by most leading Democrats until it released its latest report last week regarding systematic violations of international humanitarian law by the Zionist regime, a very close U.S. ally. The 280-page report systematically examined the Zionist regime's fragmentation of the Palestinian population into zones of control, dispossession of land and property, segregation, restrictions on economic and social rights, home demolitions and forced evictions, family separations and other human rights violations. It made a very strong case that such practices collectively constitute the legal definition of apartheid, that is, serious human rights violations perpetrated in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another, with the intention to maintain that system. Despite the compelling nature of Amnesty's investigation, U.S. Ambassador to the occupied territories, Tom Knives, immediately called the well-researched report absurd. And U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price roundly rejected the report's conclusion as well, adding, "The Jewish people must not be denied the right to self-determination, even though there was nothing in the report questioning that." Price prevaricated when asked by a reporter why the State Department was so quick to denounce Amnesty in this case, while being quite willing to cite Amnesty authoritatively when it criticized governments opposed by Washington. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer falsely claimed that Amnesty's detailed report on the Zionist regime's violations of international humanitarian law constituted delegitimizing the existence of Israel, despite absolutely nothing in the report questioning the Zionist regime's legitimacy in any way. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Robert Menendez, without offering specifics, accused Amnesty of slander and misinformation, baselessly claiming that the organization was denying Israel's right to exist. The Senate Democrats' de facto foreign policy spokesman insisted that the Zionist regime actually values human rights, despite findings to the contrary in countless well-documented reports from Amnesty and other human rights groups. Representative Gregory Meeks, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, claimed that implementing Amnesty International's recommendations to challenge the Zionist regime's apartheid policies in the West Bank would threaten Israel's existence. Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer made clear that the Democratic caucus remained solidly in support of the Zionist regime against human rights groups, insisting that Amnesty was fueling hatred against Jews and pledging that the Democratic House Majority will continue to stand with Israel and Jewish communities in effort to end the spread of misinformation and the vilification of Israel and Jews. other congressional Democrats jumped on the attack. A joint statement by Representatives Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Brad Schneider, Lois Frankel, Ellen Luria, Kathy Manning, Josh Gottemeyer, Dean Phillips, Brad Sherman, and Jake Achiklas explicitly denied well-documented Zionist regime human rights abuses and insisted that the Zionist regime was actually a vibrant democracy where all citizens, regardless of religion or race, have rights. These prominent Democratic lawmakers falsely claimed that the report is steeped in anti-Semitism and claimed that Amnesty's willingness to criticize well-documented violations of international humanitarian law was part of Amnesty's broad, decades-long campaign to criminalize and delegitimize the world's only Jewish state. Indeed, in recent years, as the discrimination against Palestinians in areas controlled by the Zionist regime has become increasingly severe and institutionalized under a series of U.S.-backed right-wing governments, multiple other human rights groups, including Human Rights Watch and the Israeli group B'Tselem, have also started using the term apartheid in regard to the Zionist regime's policies, as have world leaders including former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, and former US Secretary of War James Mattis, among others. A second charge by Biden officials and congressional leaders was that Amnesty International was unfairly singling out the Zionist regime for its criticism. In reality, over the past dozen years, Amnesty International has published over 2,000 reports, and only 35 have been about the Zionist regime. Nothing in the report was anti-Semitic. Indeed, over a dozen prominent Israeli NGOs have penned a letter defending Amnesty from these spurious charges, noting how the struggle against anti-Semitism in the world is being weakened by the unbearable, inaccurate, and instrumentalized use to which the anti-Semitism accusation is lodged for political ends in order to avoid debate about the Zionist regime's oppressive policies toward the Palestinians. Given these brazen misrepresentations, it is doubtful that the Congress members or Biden administration officials who are criticizing the Amnesty report have actually read it fully. What mattered was that it challenged a basic premise of U.S. West Asia region policy that the Zionist regime is, as described in the 2016 Democratic platform, as they claim baselessly, a beacon of democracy, equality, tolerance, and pluralism. This assertion has for decades been used to justify tens of billions of taxpayer dollars to arm dead regimes, right-wing cabinets, block the United Nations Security Council from taking action to resolve the conflict, defend the Zionist regime's war crimes, and advance the notion that it is the Palestinians under occupation, not the Israeli regime's occupiers, who are responsible for the failure to reach a negotiated peace settlement. What may have also provoked such a fiery reaction is the section of the report which appears to be referring to the United States. It reads, "Apartheid has no place in our world, and states which choose to make allowances for Israel will find themselves on the wrong side of history. Governments who continue to supply Israel with arms and shield it from accountability at the UN are supporting a system of apartheid, undermining the international legal order and exacerbating the suffering of the Palestinian people," unquote. It is this recognition that the United States has a moral and legal responsibility to end its support for violations of international humanitarian law committed by strategic allies that has led so many leading Democrats to side with the Republican right in its attacks on Amnesty International. This intensified in subsequent decades when the organization reported human rights abuses by U.S.-backed Latin American dictatorships and paramilitaries, exposed the massacres by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in East Timor, criticized torture by U.S. interrogators in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and documented the large civilian death toll in airstrikes by U.S.-armed Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip and U.S.-armed Saudi forces in Yemen. This time, as an indication of the rightward drift of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration and congressional Democratic leaders have agreed with the Republicans that research documenting violations of international humanitarian law by U.S. allies can no longer be tolerated. They have decided to take the political risks of attacking the world's leading human rights organization and lie about the contents of its reports to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Why would so many prominent Democrats risk alienating so many people in their base, including millions of liberals who have long supported Amnesty and other human rights groups, by making demonstrably false charges against this beloved and well-respected NGO? Perhaps they assume that relatively few people will actually read the report, and that enough of the public will believe their false claims about it to undermine Amnesty's reputation for fairness. Amnesty's reputation for critiquing human rights abuses across the board has been one of its greatest strengths. The organization has been critical of human rights abuses regardless of the violator's ideology, geopolitical alignment, ethnicity, religion, or anything else. The organization's reports have fueled movements to end U.S. culpability in war crimes, which threaten the profits of politically influential arms exporters. Perhaps the Biden administration and its supporters are making these false accusations that Amnesty International actually seeks to delegitimize or unfairly single out Israel in the hopes that it will damage Amnesty's reputation enough that reports about violations of international humanitarian law by other U.S. allies will not be taken seriously either. If the Biden administration and Democratic congressional leaders can get away with attacking Amnesty International for its criticisms of the Zionist regime's violations of international law, they could also start attacking Amnesty for its criticisms of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and other U.S. allies. Given the preeminence of Amnesty International in the global human rights movement, this is nothing less than a frontal attack on the human rights community as a whole. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world. Even when Democratic leaders initially rejected calls for sanctions on white minority-ruled South Africa, they opposed military aid to the regime and were outspoken in their opposition to apartheid. By contrast, today they support unconditional military aid to the Zionist regime, deny that the system imposed by that right-wing cabinet on the occupied West Bank is a form of apartheid and attack reputable human rights groups that present evidence otherwise. The Democrats figure that, with so many people scared of a Republican takeover of the House and Senate in November, human rights supporters will be reluctant to challenge their war on amnesty and other groups. This may end up hurting the Democratic Party, however. With Biden administration officials, both the House and Senate majority leaders, heads of both the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees, and scores of other congressional Democrats joining Fox News and the Republicans in attacking, misrepresenting, and outright lying in an effort to discredit and marginalize one of the world's foremost human rights organizations, people may start wondering whether they can support both human rights and Democratic Party.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The West has declared the collapse of the Russian economy as its goal over its offensive in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says the sharp rise in prices of fuel, grain and other goods, as well as record inflation, hit unfriendly countries almost harder. In the meantime, Russia is reorienting its economy to new markets, and Iran is one of them. Level of trade between Russia and Iran hit a new record in 2021, surpassing the equivalent of $4 billion, with Russian exports to Iran accounting for more than $3 billion of that figure, and Russian imports reaching $967.3 million, up to 21.4% more than a year earlier. During a meeting between business circles of the two countries, businessmen and economic experts discussed readiness from both sides to increase their trade level.
Under heavy Western sanctions, Iran seeks opportunities in boosting foreign trade with Russia. The share of mutual trade between the Russian Federation and Iran is insignificant, but our responsible persons have a serious determination to increase this share. Our goal is to increase trade with Russia to at least $10 billion. This is in the short term.
Meanwhile, entrepreneurs from both countries say they are looking for opportunities to enter the market of the opposite countries.
We are very interested in increasing trade with Iran because the Republic of Dagestan and Iran are close, both by the Caspian Sea and the land route. Prices for Iranian goods are also very attractive for us.
Russia is a very attractive market for us, and we have been trying to enter it for several years. We want to export dairy products, but there are many issues. Banking and customs relations, obtaining permits for Iranian plants, including veterinary ones. There is a lack of professional advice, which slows down work.
As Western countries are increasing their economic pressure on Russia, the country has focused on rapid import substitution and the markets of other countries that have not imposed sanctions on Moscow. Iran has also announced agreements with Russia on the use of national currencies in trade.
Foreign participants know that Russia can use the experience of countries like Iran to foil Western sanctions. They also say boosting economic partnership between Moscow and Iran will help both countries contain Western pressure. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea test launched a solid fuel space rocket designed to place a satellite into low orbit for surveillance and reconnaissance of North Korea. The test comes just 1 week after North Korea tested a long-range ICBM, prompting a UN Security Council emergency meeting and more sanctions from the United States. Activists in South Korea argue that the behavior of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and its double standards cause tension.
Now they say a lot about the missiles launched by North Korea, but nobody criticizes South Korea and the U.S. firing ICBMs and various other missiles. I think that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is getting worse because of such a hypocritical attitude.
The U.S. last year agreed to allow South Korea to develop missiles of unlimited range. President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has said he will strengthen the country's alliance with the U.S. and the missiles Seoul deploys, policies garnering significant support.
The ability to quickly receive various military and security information thanks to satellites will strengthen national defense. The stronger our national defense, the more it might provoke North Korea. But I think that the stronger our power, the more it can contribute to peace.
South Korea's president-elect also advocates the preparation of a preemptive missile attack on North Korea if Pyongyang poses an imminent threat. South Korea appears determined to develop space-based military applications in line with its alliance with the United States. South Korea's Air Force chief is scheduled to travel to the U.S. Space and Missile Command next week and discuss South Korea joining a multilateral space alliance led by Washington. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Partygate scandal lingers on, with the roll call of shame growing ever longer with every leak. On Tuesday, more bad news for Prime Minister Boris Johnson's inner circle as the identity of another high-profile COVID rule-breaker was revealed. Helen McNamara, ironically the government's former ethics chief, has apologised for her part in attending a party on June 18, 2020 in the Cabinet Office during the height of COVID restrictions, calling it an error in judgement. There has been criticism of the way the Partygate scandal continues to be addressed by the government and why the identities of those issued with fines has still not been made public.
It's fairly amazing. If either you or me had been fined for breaking lockdown, I'm sure our names would have been in the public domain, in the media, etc. Here we have very high-profile people indeed who have been fined and we're not allowed, supposed to know their names. Now, some names have leaked out. We know that Helen McNamara was incredibly in charge of ethics and propriety for Downing Street. And she has been fined. We know that Kate Josephs, who credibly was running the COVID task force at the time, had a leaving party. She went off to Sheffield City Council to get a new job. She was in charge of the COVID task force and was breaking the COVID lockdown restrictions.
With the next phase of the Sue Gray report expected to be published in May, there is mounting pressure for full disclosure to avoid further embarrassment.
Parliamentarians in the building behind me, many of them from the government's own benches, are growing tired of the constant drip-drip of leaks and names, with every week seemingly bringing fresh revelations. Whilst there have been pushes to have full transparency over Partygate, there has been some resistance from the very heart of government. Seemingly, some argue, so the public loses interest.
Despite the Prime Minister seemingly benefiting from other issues like Ukraine taking centre stage, there is still a sense of anger and injustice levelled at Boris Johnson and his colleagues who flouted the very rules they created.
I think it matters for ordinary people because many of us were told we couldn't go to a funeral of a loved one, we couldn't go to a wedding, we couldn't go to many things. Close relatives, including parents and loved ones, dying. And they weren't allowed to see them prior to the death. So I think ordinary people feel that there is one law for them in regards to the lockdown over coronavirus and one law for other people at the top in Downing Street who could get away with having parties, could get away with breaking the restrictions which the rest of us had to put up with.
The Met says investigations continue with the prospects of more fines being issued. Amina Taylor, London.
Shocking statistics released by a Muslim charity last Friday revealed that a staggering half of all Muslim households in Britain will not have enough money to feed their families when breaking their fast this Ramadan. Islamic Relief estimated that half of all British Muslim households are living in poverty. That's 1.6 million people compared to the 18% of the population in general. The UK is going through a major financial crisis, with the COVID pandemic and the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine pitted as the two main contributors towards skyrocketing inflation and a lack of fuel supply. As poverty spreads, food banks come under increasing pressure to deliver. London-based Sufra explained their concerns for the situation.
Muslim families in the borough are particularly affected, especially due to the housing benefit cap, for example, which disproportionately affects families that have more than two children, which, you know, applies to a lot of Muslim families. And so there are families that are living in inappropriate accommodation and not accessing the benefits that they should be entitled to because of these unfair policies. All we're doing is seeing numbers rising. We're hearing firsthand from guests how worried they are, especially now that we're in April, we're in this new financial year, and the guests that are coming through the door are extremely worried about the energy bills that are going to hit them this month.
During Ramadan, Muslims who can afford it make a religious donation to help others less well off, called zakat. With the economy wavering, more will be forced to rely on this generosity of strangers just to survive. Robert Carter, London.
Hundreds of South Korean farmers and fishers protested in the country's financial and political center, Yoido, demanding the government reconsider its intention to enter into yet another free trade agreement. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, will follow in the footsteps of previous rounds of deals. The critics argue usher in cheap foreign goods and jeopardize domestic producers.
In the past, during the Uruguay round, the government made fun of the farmers once, And then, during the South Korea-US and South Korea-China FTAs, they deceived our farmers a second time. With the indoctrination of the CPTPP, we are about to be deceived a third time. Should we be deceived?
The 11-member CPTPP includes Vietnam, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Mexico. South Korea only a month ago joined a 15-member trade bloc led by China, as Seoul moves to open 90% of the country's agricultural market. Farmers and fishers demand consultation.
When the government tries to introduce this type of thing, it has to have some policies prepared, discussing with farmers to some extent, and there should be some hope for agriculture and rural areas. But I don't